Hello and welcome back to the history of video games. My name is Ben and I'm joined by the one and only Wes. How you doing today, Wes?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm just chilling. Been playing some more games as I've been doing.
Love to hear it.
Yeah.
That's what we're here to do, you know?
Yeah. But one of these games, there's kind of a weird backstory to it. I kind of want to hop into it, Wes.
Yeah, yeah.
I sent this to you. So this was an RPG that I made in RPG Maker MX or MV or something.
Right. There's a lot of them.
Yeah. Some RPG Maker, which I got in my Humble Bundle. And I thought, well, how do I play this game? It's like a piece of software. It's not even on the game side on Steam, like the games list. But it was part of the Humble Bundle, so I thought, how do I play this? So I made a small RPG and sent it over to you, and I'm very interested to hear what you thought of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, my first Ben original game playing.
Yeah.
It was very cool. And I don't know if every single RPG Maker is like this, because I've heard of it before, but I've never played an RPG Maker game, at least as far as I know. But it's very much in the style of old school JRPG, like early Final Fantasy. You have a party of four people, turn-based. You can buy equipment, stuff like that. And if this was a fan fiction, I guess what you made would be called like a self-insert. Because the party of four people is you, me, Chris, who's been on the podcast a couple times, and one of our other good friends, JT. So that was really fun. And it's a great... It's fun. I don't know how long it took you to make. Maybe I'll talk about that a little bit, but like you just made this little condensed RPG that was basically full of crude humor for one, which especially in that group of friends is our jam, and lots of inside jokes. It was great. So I had a good time with it. I mean, it's knowing that it came from an RPG Maker thing. I was kind of like curious about that. So I was keeping an eye out and being like, oh, okay, here's all these building blocks. Here's how you must build the terrain. Here's how you build dialogue and stuff like that. But it flowed well, other than the second enemy I fought who destroyed me. But after...
Which one was that?
These three monsters that had eyeballs and lots of tentacles.
Okay. Maybe that was like a boss and you just went right for them.
Yeah, because the sprites also are interesting. They don't exactly, the overworld sprites don't exactly show you what you're going to be fighting.
Exactly, yep.
I'm sure there's limited options, but you know, it was like a cat and then two hornets appeared and I was like, what the heck?
Yep.
But it was fun. I mean, it very intuitive. I don't play that type of genre a lot, but I knew what to do. Very happy that despite being the primary healer, I ended up doing tons of damage, my character, at least. And it was really cool. You had dialogue, you had story, which was really funny. You had a trader, so you could buy gear. You made it kind of this super condensed experience where you level very, very fast. So you just keep fighting more powerful stuff. The final enemy is Man Ray from SpongeBob, or at least a close approximation of him. It looks a little bit more like a primordial interdimensional robot being or something.
That's what Man Ray looks like.
Yeah, yeah, basically, right? No, but it was fun. And you said you thought it would take 30 minutes and it ended up taking me 32 to beat, only that one death and lots of saving on my second attempt.
Okay, good.
Yeah, thank you for the advice on that, because the first time I died, it wasn't that much time lost, but I was like, oh, that's punishing.
Yeah, the reason I was playtesting it, basically it took me 2 days to make. I made pretty much everything on one day, and then I spent another day just playtesting and just tweaking and making sure it worked right. And yeah, like I died a lot because it can quickly turn. There was one time I was playtesting and one of the leader enemies is a chimera and it could paralyze the party. And in the base game, paralysis was permanent until you went to a healer. So on like the second turn of the fight, it paralyzed two of four party members and then it was like immediate game over.
Oh yeah.
And luckily I figured out how to make it so that you've got like, I think a 15% chance to come out of it every turn. So that was a little bit better. But I was like, this is permanent. What? How am I supposed to beat this guy with two dudes?
Well, that's cool. That's cool that you can tweak on that level. Like what status effects do or their duration or stuff like that. So that's interesting. It sounds like you had a decent bit of control over kind of how the enemies interact with players.
Kind of. The whole thing was very confusing. Like I launched the program and this is like, I don't know, the fourth or fifth version of this program, right? And it sells for like $40 on Steam, like to this day. So I'm assuming this is like some sort of big program. And I open it up and there's just like an empty box. No tutorial at all. And I'm thinking, how am I supposed to know what to do? And I figure out, go to the help section and there's a manual that kind of explains things. But I'm like, that's already less than I was expecting. And the game has like a lot and also not a lot at the same time. Like, it was hard for me to create new dungeon designs, and I only had four very, very small dungeons. But it was hard for me to make more because the palettes that you could choose from for the sprites of the overworld were just not that interesting, or like there wasn't that many options.
Right.
And even the enemies, like you mentioned it with the cat, and then you talk to it, and then you battle some wasps. Like, why isn't there just a wasp enemy sprite? There, it wasn't an option for me. I had to pick some random, like, animal. So I was kind of like, the whole time I was doing it, I was kind of, on one hand, happy that I was able to do certain things I really wanted to do. Like, for example, the main kind of premise of this game is you have to fight three mini dungeons, and then a path opens up to the final dungeon. And getting that path to open up, I really wanted to make happen, and I wanted like the screen to shake and stuff when it happened. And I was able to do all of that, which is really cool. But then other simple things like not even being able to see your party when they fight, I was like, why is that happening? Like, don't you have a sprite for a party when they're in the battle, but they don't, you can't see your party.
Right.
And even, you know, the enemies, there was probably 30 enemies I could choose from or something like that. And I probably use like 15 of them in that. I every encounter on my little mini game was a different enemy. I didn't reuse any. So there were, I used like half of them, including the final boss. And a lot of my playtesting was like the template for the final boss was like level 100 deals 1,000 damage, you know? I had to be like, no, we're not there yet. They're going to be like level 10. So that was a lot of my playtesting, but yeah, like
interesting.
Other things like making a healer work, it was all kind of set up like classes.
Like town-like healer, right? Like the one that you go to.
That was all like set up pretty much. I just had to add one and say you're the healer. Same thing with the shop guy. I could add the items in the shop, and I just kind of randomly picked some. And for the characters, like they had kind of preset templates for different classes. I just kind of picked our classes and the sprites of our characters. And then I noticed that our friend Chris, like, he was like awful all the way through the game. So I tried to make him better by just raising his stats a lot. But yeah, I don't know. There was like a fair amount of restrictions, and then also a fair amount that you could do, but I was just, for something that sells for $40, like I feel like I could make this in a browser, you know, creator. So why am I paying $40 for it? And it's not because of the art assets. You would think it would be. I don't know. I think it's for the programming of things, but.
And I was looking it up now, and I think the version that you have may actually only be $12 now, but the newest version, unless I'm mistaken, is $40. So hopefully they made lots of improvements.
I hope so. It just felt like the beginning of an RPG maker, like the free trial version, but that was the full thing, you know?
Right.
So it was a little weird. Now, were you able to play in full screen? Because I was not.
No. It was a very tiny window.
That's something else. I was like, why? I would have just assumed that would have been the case, but I was not even given an option to make that happen. So there was a lot of weird things. There wasn't a way to quickly do save states in the editor. So if imagine making a game 200 hours long, how do you play test the ending? You'd have to like start the party at like level 50, you know, and then play the ending and just play test the ending like that and just assume that up until then you were level 50. I think it'd be very hard to play test a big game.
Without making save states.
Yeah. You know, I would go all the way through and then there'd be a game breaking. Like for me, it was getting the three paths to open up the one path. If that didn't work, I just wasted like 20 minutes fighting through three dungeons. I was like, oh, okay. I guess I got to do that again. So, yeah, it was kind of weird. And even some of the behind the scenes stuff was weird. Like I wanted, as I mentioned, these three mini dungeons after you beat them for the path to open. But the path would only accept like two triggers. So basically what I did was when you defeat two of them, it triggered like trigger three. And then when triggers three and four were triggered, that's when the path opened. So lots of really roundabout things, but it works. But it's just you wouldn't think of it. It's like its own language, you know?
Right, right. And a lot of learning involved to be able to figure out how to make those systems work. Yeah. It's still neat that you can do that, and hopefully there's more sophisticated versions of it now, because I don't know how the rights work and the licensing, but I'm pretty sure people make RPG Maker games and then sell them on Steam, or maybe they put them up for free for people to download. Mm-hmm. But I've definitely heard of people playing them before, so it's an interesting system. Yeah,
it was. And it was cool, like adding text or like little story things was pretty easy, although again, something weird happened where when I first put in all the text, it went beyond the bounds of the text box. So it would go off the screen.
Oh.
And I'd be like, well, that's annoying. So every line of text, when there's multiple lines, I had to manually like do the indent.
Oh.
So that was, there's just a lot of weird stuff, but it was at least easy to set up. So it's all right. I wouldn't spend more than $12 on it, but if it's for $12, then that's. Right, yeah, I have version VX, I think.
Okay.
Which I guess is not the new one. I don't know. I was kind of expecting a lot since this is like a paid thing. And I felt like I kind of got what I could do in like some D&D makers kind of for free.
Right.
At least as far as art assets anyway. And I don't know. I feel like just coding it yourself isn't that bad. I don't know. I've coded some simple stuff. I think it'd be not too hard.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my experience with it. I'm glad that you liked it.
Yeah, I mean, at least fun for the endeavor for that little 30-minute adventure.
Yeah. Good, good. All right. Was there anything else you were playing this week? Because that one only took you half hour.
Yeah, honestly, not too much. I mean, more Baldur's Gate, but not too much more to say about that yet. I just got into Act 2. Which I believe there are three acts. I'm trying not to look it up because I don't want to spoil myself, but and that was around 40 hours of gameplay. So I'm not terribly worried that I'm not going to get my money's worth here.
Yeah.
It's been really good.
I would say so.
I'm really trying to explore every possibility, which has me a little bit worried for replayability, but there's so many different reactions to how you play the game. I'm sure there's going to be lots of reasons to replay it, even if I have seen most of the side quests.
I feel like, so I will eventually get this game once it goes on sale. Yeah. And I think I might do like an evil character. Because I never do that. Options. And I feel like a game like Baldur's Gate, there's going to be some pretty fun evil stuff.
There absolutely is. And there's definitely stuff I want to try that. I don't know if I could go full evil, but morally gray. And tiny spoiler that I hope you won't mind, but there is at least one companion that you can get that you can only get if you're evil. So there are like different party members and stuff based on that, at least one. Yeah, so it's continues to be a fantastic game, and I will update more as I progress further.
cool.
But yeah, with that, why don't we move on to our special topic for the day? It is a weird one, and I had no idea what the play cable for the Intellivision was when you showed this to me, Ben. But my brief summary before we jump into what it is going to be, what if Xbox Game Pass, but through your cable provider and through your TV? And that's...
In 1981.
And that's kind of what the Play Cable is. It's ridiculous. Development for it actually started back in 1979 before the Intellivision was even released. And it's a joint venture between Mattel and General Instruments to create this. And both of them ended up selling the play cable under their labels, but it was the same thing. And through these years, in 79 up to 81, it was tested in several different cities before it was released. And the basic setup of this system was that a cable provider, which I guess Mattel and General Instruments worked with a few different cable providers to get to agree for them to do this service, they had a PDP-11 that they would use to broadcast the play cable main menu system on a certain frequency over the cable lines, and also all of the games that could be played and downloaded. And you would plug your play cable adapter into the Intellivision, which then is plugged into the TV, and so it can pick up the cable signal, and it would pick up the FM cable signals on an empty channel. So you would turn to an empty channel, and you would be on the play cable channel, and you could actually download games through your cable TV, which is kind of crazy to think about for 1981. I don't have a great understanding of it. I mean, obviously, cables transmit data, but the idea that you could download stuff from it, I was like, wait, does that work that way? Like, it seems very weird, but obviously they figured out a way to do it. And yeah, so that is, it was provided through your cable provider, you know, in partnership with Mattel. And it was actually, like modern day systems, a subscription service where you would pay $12 monthly and you could access any of the games on the Play Cable channel and download them onto your Intellivision. The adapter had, I've seen conflicting reports, it either had 4K or 8K of RAM. A lot of the games for the Intellivision were 4K, but there are going to be some 8K releases down the line. But then it would take the games that you downloaded onto that adapter, and you could only store one game at a time on there, play it on the system. But once you had it downloaded, as long as the system was still on, you could play it as much as you wanted. There was no time limit or anything. And then once you turned it off, you'd have to re-download or download a new game. But apparently this process didn't take all that long, which is amazing considering it was going through your cable provider. The marketing around the subscription service was also pretty funny. The idea was that it gave you access to 15 games at a time. And they said, you know, most of our games cost around $25, so it's $500 worth of games, which is funny because they're kind of like saying, hey, don't buy our games, get this subscription service instead.
Yeah.
But I guess they knew in the long run it would end up making them more money. But it just seems funny in the commercials because they're kind of like, these guys cost 25. And it's like, you're talking about your own games. Nobody else is making Intellivision games.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing about these commercials is that many of them were done by famous baseball player Mickey Mantle, which just seems kind of crazy. I mean, I guess Mattel really is the one to be able to do this with all their sponsored sports video games.
Yep.
And the commercials really did lean into the sports roots. There's one where a van labeled Play Cable pulls up to a house. The kids are all excited. And then like a bunch of different people dressed in different sports uniforms come marching out into their house. But also, sort of like Game Pass or PlayStation Now, the available 15 games, we think, rotated monthly. We're not positive on this. It may also be that they just added games monthly because we have seen what looks like manuals that were shipped with the Play Cable adapter for more than 15 games. And those may have also come with overlays because the Intellivision had the numpad controller that needed overlays to be able to really understand what the buttons did. But we're not too sure about that either. But either way, there was sort of varying access to games that you could download on Play Cable. And because it relied on certain cable providers, it actually was only available in 13 cities in the US when it launched in 1981. So it definitely wasn't ever a huge hit. I think it reportedly never got higher than 10,000 subscribers at its peak. So it's pretty small, but it's just kind of amazing that this existed in 1981. I think we'll see it for a couple of years, but it did have some issues with the system. Cable providers were complaining about the high cost of running the PDP-11 computers. And all games that were released on Play Cable were also released in cartridge form. So it was kind of a weird thing going on there where there was no exclusivity, although that's good for us because the Play Cable is not around anymore, and there's no way to play the Play Cable games. So it's nice that all the games that were on it are on cartridge form. People have tried to get, you know, mock versions of the menu running again, but since it ran off that cable connection and the signal it was sending, it's really can't work at all today. But yeah, it's just this really interesting system. The menu also had background music that played for the whole time you were on the menu, which is great. It's just such a unique thing in 1981.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you want to add, Ben? Or
Just two things real quick. I just want to mention some of the games that you could get through the subscription service. A lot of ones that we've seen, and obviously they're still going to be adding new ones over the course of the next few years. But some of the stuff that you could get probably still like right away in 81 were games like Golf and Armor Battle, Astro Smash, which is kind of like Space Invaders, Sea Battle, Baseball, Skiing, which we just did not too long ago, Word Fun, Poker Blackjack, a decent amount of games. It's like all the main games, you know, I would say.
Yeah.
So they did a good job there. And then the only other thing I kind of noticed when we were looking into this is that at least two people, according to the website blueskyrangers.com, were able to essentially like take the data that the Play Cable was importing and reverse engineer how to make a game in the Intellivision, like basically make an Intellivision dev kit. And at least one of these parties sent a letter to Intellivision saying that we are going to release games for your system, whether you want us to or not. Yeah. Why don't you at least work with us, and then it'll be under your name, and we'll give you some like royalties. And they agreed. So the game Bump and Jump, which I guess we haven't seen it yet, but I think it comes out maybe in 83 or something, was made by somebody who reverse engineered the Play Cable and essentially like blackmailed Intellivision to sell it. So I just thought that was really funny. And I think it's one of the reasons why the Play Cable is not going to be around too much longer, because Mattel was worried that, like, you know, real actual competitors were going to do this as well. So yeah, I guess there's some issues when you're dealing with new technology, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting story.
But with that being said, let's head over into the games. There's no Intellivision ones today, but we do have some 2600 titles and a bunch of other stuff. So let's check it out.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Let's jump into our timeline today and talk about some games. The first one we have here is an honorable mention. I'm going to butcher the name slightly, apologies, but I believe it's Jarinko GA by Bandai. And it was a handheld game. It was a simple game where you have to catch food that's being thrown at you. It did have some background characters with animation, which was nice, and it's based off a Japanese anime that was going on at the time.
Yep, and then we've got another handheld here. It's called Banana, part of the Time and Fun series by VTech. I think it might be the second one that we've looked at. I can't quite remember, but you definitely did Monkey not too long ago. Mm-hmm. It's basically like the big competitor to Game & Watch from Nintendo. But on this one, you have to prevent people from slipping on bananas by what looks like just putting your hand on top of the banana and then they step on your hand. I don't know, something like that. But basically, there's like, I think there's four bananas. They're always on screen, and you have to just move, you know, go in between them, making sure people step on your hand and not slip on a banana. So I don't really know what the story there is, but it's pretty weird.
Somebody being a literal doormat, I think, is the story
there. Why doesn't he just pick up the bananas?
Right. No. That's too complicated.
It was just okay. It wasn't anything too crazy or different than what we've seen before. I read that it's actually based off of the Game & Watch game Manhole, I think we've mentioned, but it seemed at least pretty different to me as far as just the visuals go, but maybe gameplay is similar.
And there were a couple clones for Banana as well. We have Banana by Acetronic, Banana by Intrek, and Poo de Banani by Ludotronic.
Cool. All right, moving on to some computer games. We mentioned the ZX81 in a special topic not too long ago, but there were a lot of games for it that came out in 81 that were just not that interesting or that we didn't really want to look at. Stuff like Defender clones, Maze games, Hammurabi clones, or Lunar Lander, Blackjack games. So they're all on this list. This list will be up on our website. You can find it under the sources section. But we're not going to read them all because there's like 60 of them. But we know that they existed and that they came out in 81, so we had to document it. So it's there.
Doing this for science. Not really, for history, but we got it. History. All right, and next up, we have a game called Halls of Death by Supersoft. Great name. Advertised in Computing Today in the April issue, and it was a large CRPG that came out for the PET. This version, though, seems to be lost, so we're going to play it when it releases later on the Commodore 64.
All right, and then moving on, I'm going to have a couple extended mentions here, just games that were pretty cool, but maybe not. They wouldn't have scored well. We'll put it that way. The first one is called Olympic Decathlon by Microsoft. Microsoft. They did make some games like Microsoft Adventure, although they all are also well known for Microsoft Basic or MS-DOS. So they kind of have their hands on all bunch of things. But this one is kind of weird. Olympic Decathlon is a multiplayer game on the Apple II and features 10 different Olympic-themed challenges or sports. And at the end, you add up your score for how you did in the whole decathlon, and then that's the game. Each sport is basically a little mini game, and usually just involves something like a timing-based thing, such as jumping a hurdle or getting a certain angle right or throwing something, maybe. Some of them were pretty cool, I thought. Overall, the graphics were pretty nice. You can definitely tell that these Olympic people that you're using have decently detailed bodies. Most of them are stick figures. At times, for some of the sports, you get a more zoomed in view, like in shot put, you can actually see the guy's like arm and elbow move, which is kind of cool. Of the 10 games, and I have no idea if this is like how the official decathlons, like the sports that are in them, I have no idea. But for this game, the 10 sports were the 100 meter dash, the long jump, the shot put, the high jump, the 400 meter, hurdles, discus, pole vaulting, javelin, and 1500 meters. I have no idea how they made the three running ones different. But the ones I mainly picked out and were able to play were like hurdles, you know, that's kind of just like steeplechase or some jumping over a hurdle game. The pole vaulting and discus and shot put were all pretty fun, and even the long jumps I thought were kind of fun. You kind of had to like press a button to kind of launch and then press another button to basically, like, there'd be a little, like, shadow of your guy that kind of moved in across the screen in an angle, and then you had to hit a second button to pick the angle of the jump or throw or something. So I thought the mechanics were kind of interesting, at least between several of the sports. There was one, I can't remember if it was shot put or this, I think it was discus, where I think that's the one in where you kind of curl like a big weight around in circles really quickly, and so you just saw like this circle moving really quickly along the screen. You just had to press a button to fire it, and it seemed pretty random because it moved so fast. Like, how would you be good at timing it? But it worked. It made me feel like that's probably the best way to do that sport, I don't know, in a video game. So I thought it was pretty cool, although not a whole lot of sound. All the games are like hit two buttons and then wait a bunch, you know, for like a little screen to kind of play out or to see what happened. So it wasn't that fun to play. It was just fairly interesting to check out. So I liked it. But the second one here is another one. I thought I would really like this one. But unfortunately, without like a guide to help me with it, I couldn't really progress in the game. I didn't feel comfortable giving it a rating. But it's called The Maze by Fermented Software. And it's a maze game with text adventure puzzle elements in it. So like you start off the game and there's a welcome mat like in this wireframe maze that we've seen 100 times. But there's a welcome mat, and I, of course, took the welcome mat, and there was a key under the welcome mat, and I took the key, kind of like in a text adventure. I ended up using the key to open up a violin case and got a violin, and at that point, I got lost in the maze. The maze is huge. It takes quite a while for it to draw. It's on the Apple II. It is pretty colorful. Like, some of the walls in the maze are not just blank, but are kind of filled with color. So it's not like in a way to make like this corner of the ways be memorable or anything like that. It's more just like all the walls on the left hand side are like kind of green and on the right are kind of blue or something. So it made a bit of a difference. I have seen screenshots of a monster in the maze that I don't know if it moves or anything. The screenshot just shows a face but no body. I never saw the monster when I was playing and I kind of just got stuck. So I couldn't really do too much else without like a guide to help me. I'm just not good enough at text adventures. But I thought it was pretty cool just considering that it's this kind of wireframe maze style. We don't see as many of them as opposed to a traditional graphical text adventure. But it was cool. I thought there was some puzzles. There's some enemies. I thought this is something a little different. So I wanted to mention it and check it out. With some decent graphics, some color there, some characters. But I'm not good at the game. So
I mean, it sounds like a hard game to be good at, to be fair.
And it seems like a rare game, too, by the way. It just says because like none of our usual sources covered it. But I guess since it's not a traditional text adventure, maybe.
Yeah, we don't really haven't really heard anything from Fermented Software before, as far as I know. So they're.
No.
Who knows? Maybe it was a bit of a one-off.
I couldn't even find the name of the guy who made it. Only Fermented Software, you know? No credit to an author.
Interesting. All right, well, let's move on now to some more honorable mentions. We have one here called Tangerine Face Invaders. It was on the Microtan 65. And the Microtan 65 also had an Othello and Hangman game released for it this year that we haven't mentioned yet. But this one was funny because it's a Space Invaders game, basically, except you're shooting pimples off of a guy's face before he gets his face permanently damaged. So,
I mean, noble cause.
Yeah, you got to give it to him for theming. I do like the Microtan just because I feel like everything has tangerine theming just because that's part of their name. Because I think that was the company name as well, right? So it's they just find a way to work it in all the time. All right, and then we have Cosmic Combat by Highlands Computer Services, which was honestly a really nice Galaxian game for the Apple II that had different enemies and waves, but, you know, we've just seen better versions of that.
Yep, and then moving on, we've got a quick update to Viper Magazine. Hopefully you guys remember that. We've talked about it previously, but they previously kind of went on hiatus for a while. This update is to say that they will be starting back up again in April and May of 1981. This was a magazine for the RCA Cosmac computer. And in this update, they mentioned that they were going nonprofit and under new leadership. I did check out all the magazines of 1981. I didn't really see anything that interesting, but I just love the name Viper Magazine.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep following.
Yeah.
Like, it makes sense because it's the Cosmic VIP. So it's like, maybe it's supposed to be VIP or magazine, and then my whole world is shattered. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it's stylized on the magazines, but, you know, we can believe it's Viper.
Yeah.
And then we also have Labyrinth by Aardvark Technical Services, which came out for the TRS-80 Coco and Ohio Scientific computers. And it was a maze game, but the main goal was to find and kill 9 monsters. You aim your weapon, sort of, and fire. So it's kind of a first-person shooter, but not really. And it runs super slow, and it's just black and white, so we didn't really end up taking a look or wanting to take a look at it. But it did have decent character sprites for the enemies.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to Southside for April of 1981. We are in April. There was nothing of note between January and March, which is a little surprising because Southside is one of our largest magazines that we cover. They always have games in them. And I think just last year they started to expand. They used to be only TRS-80 games. And now they're doing like everything. But in the April issue, we've got two games here. The first one's called Convoy by William Morris and John Cope. This is for the Atari version of the game, which the I think Apple II version came out earlier, maybe TRS-80 version. But this version is much better and is emulated, so we could play it, which was fun. It's just a ship convoy strategy game where you could navigate and fight some marines, but we have some even cooler games to talk about later.
And the second game for Softside that we wanted to talk about is Assault 4 by Gerald Upton, or Uptain. And it's a kind of slow war strategy game with minimal visuals where you have to push the enemy army back to their base. The army uses turn-based combat and allows you to reinforce your broken lines. But again, it was kind of slow and we've seen some things like this before, so we didn't end up covering it. But now we have the first game that I covered today. It's another Other Venture. That was confusing. Other Venture number 3, Escape from Tram. Ben picked me for this one, you know, because I play Escape from Tarkov and we thought, hey, you know, this guy likes escaping from stuff. Let's make him play this. But these games, the Other Venture series, are by Adventure International. I think mainly that series title was created for games that weren't by Scott Adams. And this one was by Jim Pearson, who actually did Other Venture 2, which I covered, The Curse of Crawley Manor. And that one was pretty cool. It was this fun, like, detective Sherlock Holmes sort of game that then turned into fighting the devil with a sword. So you never know where these games are going to go, is what I've learned. And I was very excited to see what Escape from Tram was all about. The graphics for the Apple II version of both of these games, I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but I believe they were done by a guy named Norm Saylor. And the manual says the average completion time for this game is 1 month. So I definitely looked up the ending and didn't try to get there myself. Just more proof that the text adventures and adventure games of this time, the expectation was sort of you would get to a point where you're stuck, die, and then start over. It did have unofficial Adventure International hint sheet, which is pretty cool. And the hint sheet was actually in code so that you had to look up, you know, what each number represented for all the hints, and you didn't accidentally spoil yourself just by glancing at the sheet, which I think is pretty cool. The basic setting is you're in a your spaceship, you crash land on an alien planet, and you have to escape. So for the gameplay for this game, it's basically the same format as The Curse of Crawley Manor, which is a graphic text adventure where you kind of toggle between the visuals and then back to the screen that it gives you the information about your surroundings and where you can type in your commands. It is very much a graphic text adventure because you are, you know, saying go north, go south, all this kind of stuff, picking up things and trying to solve puzzles as you go. But just like Curse of Crawley Manor, it is more of a narrative experience than a collect the treasure type game. You're focusing on escaping the alien planet. There's no score for collecting treasures as far as I could tell. It also has a multiple word parser, but this one is very specific. For example, S works to go south, but typing south does not, which had me stuck for a solid 5 minutes trying to figure out why I couldn't move anywhere. And also, if you type south, instead of saying, you know, that's not an accurate command, it just says, huh? And so I didn't even know what I was doing wrong. And then also, one very egregious example of this is there's a situation where there's a bush on the top of a cliff, and it's pretty clear you have to tie your rope to this bush, or it kind of looks like a tree, to get up the cliff. So you can say tie rope, but it gives you a huh and doesn't say like tie rope to what. Like sometimes we'll have adventure games that prompt you so you know what to answer. This just says huh? And the actual command you have to type in is tie nylon rope to bush. So like, I feel like we've never had a parser be that specific without giving you at least some hints along the way.
Yeah.
So that may give you a little bit of a hint of how the gameplay went for this. But also, I don't know if it was the same parser and maybe the puzzles were a little bit more simplified. I don't remember that being as much of an issue in Curse of Crawley Manor, though. And it's a little unclear which one of these was written first. They were definitely published in this order because Other Venture number 2 and number 3. But there is in some of the code for Escape from Tram a copyright date of 1980. So the Renga in Blue blog said he's not really too sure which one was written first. So this could be a slightly less experienced Jim Pearson who was writing this. But with that said, let me get into my ratings for it. For graphics, I gave it a 2.5 out of 10. Just like Curse of Crawley Manor, there's some great images here, including a wild-looking insect-like pink alien that he's reading a map, as the game describes, but it honestly looks like he's holding one of those mirror things that you use to suntan in like the 70s or whatever. There's a classic-looking spaceship. Interesting forests, lots of great colors, all the classic Apple II colors palette, but there's also some dithering involved to give the colors more depth and variety. And overall, I don't really think it looks quite as good as Curse of Crawley Manor. The screens don't seem to change as much when puzzles are solved. Like, you can't see like a tree fall down if you knock a tree down, for instance. That's not part of this game, but that's just like the kind of thing I'm looking for. Like, the rope wasn't hanging from the bush when I threw it up to climb up the cliff. And I also didn't notice any instances of zoomed in images when you inspect something. Like, I looked at my ship after it crashed and I got out of it, but it didn't like zoom in to show me the rope that I found there, which I think we did see in Curse of Crawley Manor to some extent. There are still some interesting designs though, but it's just kind of hard to top the weirdness of the growing brown blob from Crawley and the demon attacking you in like three different scenes. But definitely still some great stuff and some weird stuff since you're on an alien planet. For sounds, I gave this a 1 out of 10. Very similar to Crawley Manor, there's just sort of this one like beeping buzzing sound that plays at certain moments. The most obvious moment I noticed it in this game is when your ship is going down at the beginning and it's sort of the alarm bells going off that your ship is going to crash. And it definitely works for that well, even though it's a very simple sound. It just makes it feel more urgent and threatening. So just a little bit of sound, but it definitely helps with the story. And for gameplay, I only gave this a 2 out of 10 because I just really didn't have as much fun with Escape from Tram as I did Crawley Manor. The parser, as I mentioned, seems incredibly specific. Some puzzles were kind of nonsensical, and it just felt like you had to fail and die and restart to understand how to beat it. Renga in Blue mentioned several times where something was at the very beginning of the game in a very confusing way, and you needed to bring it with you through the whole game to get through a puzzle at the very end. Like, you dig and you find something, but if you dig in that same spot, you find a helmet that you need at the very end of the game. So some stuff, game design like that, which I'm not really a fan of. I just don't really like the focus on having to restart to beat the game, even though that is pretty popular with this genre at this time. But I do really appreciate the weird alien setting that Escape from Tram has, and just sort of the strange logic that you can get away with because you're on an alien planet. So you can be like, yeah, sure, there's a river of flowing silver or mercury, and if you drink it, you die. Like, why not? You're on an alien planet. So I do love that kind of stuff. And I could have done, though, without the aliens speaking in ciphers because I did not know how to solve it. Although maybe that's something that people liked. You know, they're just kind of speaking in jumbled up letters and you have to figure out what each letter actually represents. Not my kind of thing, but maybe it was for some people. Moving on to relevance now, I gave it a 5 out of 10 here. It's not the first of Jim Pearson's work, and it's still a novel design for a text adventure, but we have seen it in other ventures. So I don't think it was all that relevant, but I am curious to see how well it sold, because I think the series probably did all right, and Curse of Carly Manor was definitely a cool one. So I could see people being interested in this as well. So overall, that left me with a 2 out of 10 for Escape from Tram. It is a fun premise of being trapped on an alien planet and having to escape, but it has a really strict parser, some weird logic, and what seems to be a pretty mandatory amount of resets to figure out what's going on in the game. So I wasn't a fan of that, but the visuals are interesting, and it's definitely worth taking a look at, especially if you liked Crawley Manor, just because it's same style, but man, it has some weirdness to it.
All right. Did you notice, you think the graphics are improving in terms of like fidelity at all, or is this still kind of the same?
This looked about the same to me. I think the fidelity was about the same, yeah. And it may just be because this was so fantastical an environment, but I liked some of the details in Curse of Crawley Manor more. Like, I feel like because they knew what a city at night looked like, that London at night part looked really good. Whereas these, you could do whatever you want, but it kind of looked a little off at some points. Still looked right. Really good in general, though, and I do think this is like kind of the peak right now for graphical text adventures. They've been doing a good job, and it helps that it has that screen flipping thing, so it can take up the full screen instead of just being a window on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't think it'll be too much longer before the graphics really start to increase a lot. I know Scott Adams will kind of port his original adventures and make them graphical text adventures, and I think they're supposed to look pretty good. So I'm just waiting for that game that kind of takes it to the next level.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. With that being said, though, let's move on. We have a couple more computer games. We've got the Micro 80 magazine for April of 1981. This is an Australian TRS-80 only magazine. And there was nothing else of note in this magazine before April. I guess it's a brand new, it's a brand new magazine for us, but there was really nothing important for now. And there's nothing else really for the rest of the year. But in the April issue, we had a game called Grand Prix by Stephen Humphrey, and it's another car dodging game, but this one limits you to two lanes on a road, which makes the two lane kind of thing make it feel kind of like a Temple Run game, where you have to kind of quickly go between the two lanes, which I thought was kind of cool.
Nice. And then we have a game here called Robot Attack by Big Five Software, who, you know, we keep seeing, and we know that we're going to keep seeing good stuff from them. And this is actually a surprisingly decent Berserk clone for the TRS-80. It even had some voice lines, and that always impresses us when you can make a pretty decent game on the TRS-80.
Yep. And then moving on to the C-Load magazine. There was nothing of note between January and March for this magazine either. But for the April issue, we had one here called Medieval Adventure by Hugh Lampert and Mike Greenholz. It's a collect-the-treasure-style text adventure, but it's a two-player version where the players are competing for the treasures, and they spawn in different locations, and the two players can even steal from one another, but it lacks necessary anti-cheating measures to prevent you from easily finding out what the other player is doing or where they are. You could just, like...
Right, yeah.
It's not the best there, but I thought it was pretty cool, though.
Yeah, definitely an interesting kind of system. All right, but now let's move on from computer games to console games. We have a few Atari 2600 games we want to mention here. The first one is Video Pinball, which unfortunately is just kind of bad pinball.
Yeah, it's still that square pinball because they're like obsessed with using the whole screen.
Right.
Like, I don't know, it just doesn't work. But yeah, that one came out in April, and then this next one also came out in April. It's my only review for the day. And it's Missile Command for the Atari 2600. And I'm sure many of you at home are like, oh, yes, I've been waiting for this one. Because this is like one of the kind of flagship titles I think that the Atari 2600 is most remembered for. So I definitely thought I should check it out, even though we have played the original Missile Command on the podcast. We played it, I guess, last year or maybe 2 years ago. Did it make your top games of the year?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a great game, so I'm excited to see how they transition it over to the 2600.
I think they do a pretty good job, but the thing that was kind of getting me is that they're definitely lying in the packaging. So the packaging for the game, first of all, the artwork on it is always really cool for these Atari 2600 games. They're like nicely painted. I don't know. It just looks like a really cool painted image. And this one, it's got like a dude working a console, and he's got like this crazy like bowl shaped helmet on his head that looks really like 70s or 80s. And then there's just some missiles coming at you. There's a lady in the background just like looking at a console, and Jupiter in the side. So yeah, I thought the artwork was cool, but it says clearly on it 34 video games. And yeah, I don't think so. 34 variations. I don't think I would even say that. So let me get into just a quick reminder about what Missile Command is. Basically, you've got a missile base. In the original arcade game, you had three bases, I think, that each had a certain amount of missiles that they could fire from. In this one, there's only a single missile base, but there is a limited number of rockets. And your main goal is just to protect the cities that are on the screen. They're just like very small, tiny little square-looking things. There's three on either side of you. And in the game, there's missiles falling from the top of the screen. They fall very slowly, and you have to intercept them by shooting missiles of your own to meet them. And when you shoot a missile, it kind of explodes in this big explosion, and any missile, enemy missile caught in that explosion will get destroyed. And your main challenge is just to prevent all the cities from being hit and from getting destroyed, and you lose if all six of them are destroyed. There is one kind of unique mechanic added to this game, which is that there's another enemy in this game. I think they called it, what did they call it? They called it a cruise missile, but it kind of looks like a normal missile, but without like a trail behind it, which makes it a little bit harder to spot. It's basically just like a dot that moves across the screen. And part of the variations is that there's a dumb cruise missile version, which they just kind of fall straight down like a normal missile. So in that case, there's really nothing different about them at all. Or there's a smart cruise missile, which kind of just dodges a little bit and just kind of comes down in a bit of a wavy pattern. So that's the only kind of main difference. There is a certain number of stages. I don't know how high it goes. I read that stage 13 is the hardest, but it goes up to at least 15 different stages. But as far as what's different between the stages, it's just the speed of the missiles coming at you, how many of them there are, and the color palette of the ground and the city changes slightly between several of the missions, but it's nothing really big or super different. So that's pretty much all the game is. You're just kind of trying to prevent missiles from hitting the cities beside you. Your base can be hit, by the way. In the original game, your bases could be hit, but since you had three of them, it just kind of knocked one of them out of commission. In this case, since you only have one base, if that base gets hit, you instead just lose a certain amount of ammo. And since you only have so much ammo per mission, that can be a problem if you get hit too many times. I thought that was actually a pretty good way of doing things, honestly. I think you get 30 shots per like little mission or scenario, which is usually plenty enough to attack the enemies, and you can have up to three bullets on screen or explosions on screen at a time. So with that being said, let's talk about these 34 game variations. I don't know. I think the base game, as I'll mention later in my ratings, is really good, but there's just like these options are just so weak. I think we have the cruise missile thing, and then we have slow control of your cursor, which in this case, you know, you're moving with the joystick. And it's basically a cursor on screen, as in the original arcade game, you had a trackball that moved a cursor, but you got your controller and you're moving the cursor. So it's either slow cursor movement, which I don't know why you would even pick that, or fast target control or cursor movement, which is obviously the one you want.
Right.
But that's not really an option. Then another option is to pick what wave you start on. So maybe that's kind of cool because you could kind of practice the ending and just start, like if you're good at the game, you don't have to play through the first stages over and over again. But I wouldn't say that's a new variation or anything. It's just like a different part of the game you start at. And then half of the variations are for two player control. And I first thought, oh my God, two players. that means there can be like two bases shooting down missiles. That sounds amazing. But no, it's just one player at a time, and it just goes, you know, like you play a stage, and then it goes to the other controller, and they play a stage, oh, and no. then you play a stage. So it's, you could do that with one controller and just pass the controller. So I don't know how that is a, you know, something worth mentioning at all. I guess it does the scoring separate, but right. I don't know. Those are the variations. I make 34 game variations, and there, I think of all of them, only the cruise missile one is maybe a variation, but it's either between like have an enemy that acts just like every other enemy or have it actually act as a unique enemy. Like that's barely even an option, and the other ones just don't make any sense to me. So I think the base game is fine, but I was just kind of disappointed that they couldn't think of anything else to do with the game to make it more replayable or just interesting. I don't know. You could have just had like a two player and just had two bases. I think it would have been great. Just split the ammo between everybody. I think it would have been awesome, but it's just the one player game. So with all that being said, let me get into my ratings. For gameplay, I gave it a 3.25. It's not the highest rating, but it's also not a low rating either. I think 3.25 in 1981 is quite good. But as always, we always rate these things with today's standards. And I just don't think the replayability is there to really want to play this for more than like 15 minutes. It's good. It's very solid. The missiles move at the right speed. I think the difficulty is like perfect, at least in the emulator I was playing. My cursor speed was fast enough to kind of do everything I wanted to do. I was worried about that because if it's too slow, then you just can't play the game at all. So luckily that wasn't an issue. I like the ammo mechanic. I like defending the cities. If a city gets hit, it's permanently out unless you have a certain number of points that you build up. Like every time you finish a stage, you get a certain amount of points. You get more points if more cities are still standing, and more points the more ammo that you have in reserve. So after you get to, I think, 10,000 points, a city will be rebuilt. But otherwise, once a city gets hit, it's out. You have to think, like, okay, let's say there's 15 stages. There's really nothing that unique about any one of the stages. I think after stage 6, the cruise missiles start to come in, and they're a little different, but that's it. So I just didn't think it was that replayable. It just wasn't, there's not anything different between the runs, really. It is random where the missiles come between each run, which I checked. I thought that was an important part that they had to get right. So that is the case, which I enjoy. But for me to buy a whole cartridge, I just would have expected a little bit more from this, considering other games coming out this time. I don't know. So I think it's like one very solid game. But I wish there was 34 variations of it. I really do. So I gave it a 3.25 for gameplay. For graphics, I ended up giving that a 3 out of 10. I was pretty surprised. The cursor looks good. Most importantly, the explosions look really good, because that was one of the main things about the main arcade game. And so they look really good. They kind of flash in different colors, and they're very, very fun whenever you're exploding things. The like little trails behind the enemy missiles look good. I think the cities look very bad, to be honest. What's at the bottom of the screen, I don't think looks good. But everything up in the sky, and that's where the gameplay's happening, I thought looks pretty cool. I wish the cruise missiles looked distinct in any way, but they're just like a dot. So I was a little disappointed about that. But at least the color palette changes between these stages. And as I mentioned, everything up in the sky I think looks really cool. So I gave it a 3 out of 10 for graphics. For sound, I gave that a 2.75 out of 10. To me, that's like pretty darn good sound, but nothing super special. There's not really like music in the game, but there is kind of a special sound effect that plays when you start the game up. And maybe like there's like different special sound effects for a certain number of bonus points or like when a stage finishes or starts. No real music, but just different like spacey tones. And I like the general sounds of the gameplay, where when you fire a shot, there's a certain sound effect that plays as the missile kind of goes up into the air, kind of more of a whistling type sound. And then when the explosion happens, it's kind of a nice big boomy sound. And there are also some kind of more gunshotty sound effects, but it's a nice kind of variety, and there's usually a lot of sound going on. So I like the sound quite a bit. There just wasn't anything super special, like some music or something. 2.75 there. For relevance, I gave it an 8 out of 10 because I know this goes on to sell quite well on the console. It's one of the most popular games on the console. I think one of the most well-remembered. So I definitely need to give it some relevance, although not as much as the original arcade game, obviously. And overall, I gave it a 3 out of 10. I think it's very solid. I would definitely say it's in like the top 5, maybe, Atari 2600 titles that I've played. But I don't think it's going to stay there. I think it's on the lower end of that top 5. To us, as people looking back and playing games throughout history, you know, seeing like new things happen, new mechanics and innovations in gaming is probably more exciting and more fun for us to check out than something we've already seen just ported. So I imagine for many people who weren't able to play the arcade game when they got it on their home console, this was like amazing. But to me, it's very similar to what we've seen, and I thought the changes to the console version, some of them were good, like the one base I thought was good, the ammo kind of mechanic was cool, but then other things like the cruise missile, I just think was kind of a wasted thing. It wasn't that cool to me, and a lot of the variations just didn't make any sense why they were there or didn't feel like they were adding anything to the game. So I just feel like it could have been better. The cities don't look good. You know, there's just some things about it I didn't like, but I think the core gameplay is quite fun. It's a shame because I feel like it could have been better. Just as it is, I think it's good, but just not amazing.
Yeah.
And that's it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I at least appreciate that they still get the core gameplay down because they knew they had something good with that. So to be able to do it faithfully on a console, that's at least something. I'll take it.
True. Yeah. I mean, they have a lot less hardware to work with. I understand that. But then again, the Atari 2600 and like a lot of games at this time, they could have made the cartridge have more like RAM and ROM in it. They're going to do that in later years.
Right.
So I don't know how much it is, but I feel like they could have either used more, like the game just needed a little bit more to it, I think, to make it really special.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, why don't we move on now to our last game for today and also our last game for April, and it is an arcade game, Asteroids Deluxe by Atari. We have seen some dates for March, but we're putting it in April here, and it is the follow-up to Asteroids. So, long-awaited. I mean, Asteroids came out, I think, back in 1979, so they've really been sitting on that glory and fame for Asteroids for a bit, and they haven't really done too much, but this is the sequel, as it were. It has some great cabinet art, just really nice colors, great space design, cool spaceships. Love it. I mean, still pretty normal looking cabinet, but the art on it is great. And it's still vector graphics like the original, but it's now one of the reflected painted background type of arcade cabinets that we've seen a lot. And the background, the painted background is Asteroids and spaceships, and it has either like glow in the dark or blacklight paint on it. So it glows this nice, like eerie green. And it just really adds some much needed color that really makes it pop. Because I mean, this is still a black and white vector graphics game. As cool as Asteroids is, you know, it's a little lacking in the visuals, so this I feel like helps give it a lot of nice color. For the gameplay of this, I mean, obviously a lot of it is the same as Asteroids. I mean, it's not a totally new game, it is Asteroids Deluxe. But one of the biggest gameplay changes, and apparently kind of the one of the driving reasons that they wanted to make this new version is that the UFOs in the original game could be kind of tricked by either sitting right at the border and then popping to the other side of the screen and wrapping around to shoot them, or by hiding behind an asteroid and then popping out to shoot them. And apparently this strategy was so easy to exploit that pros of the original asteroids could play for multiple hours just on one credit. So obviously that means they're not making as much money. Yeah, you know.
No fun here.
Exactly.
Undetected.
Yeah, and you know, one credit, that's only one quarter, one dime, whatever it was. So yeah, can't have that. So to solve this in Asteroids Deluxe, the UFOs would actually shoot at asteroids as well, so that you couldn't just hide behind them, and it could actually aim at you through the screen wrap. So, you know, if you were on the right side of the screen and it was all the way on the left, it could aim and shoot through the screen wrap to get you. So they're definitely a little bit smarter. But that's not the only change that they made. They also added a new type of enemy called the Killer Satellite that didn't shoot at you, but it broke into multiple ships. First time you shoot it, it breaks into three, and then each of the three ships it breaks into break into two. So there's a lot of different ships it breaks into, and when they break apart, they just kind of rush you and try to collide with you. They don't shoot at you. Instead of the hyperspace button, which I feel like was one of the most divisive things for me when I first reviewed Asteroids, which if you don't remember, you just kind of hit it and then it teleported you to a random spot where there wasn't an asteroid on the screen. Now you have a temporary shield where you hold down the shield button and you're protected, but it depletes the longer you hold it and the more damage it takes. Other than that, the game is very much the same. You're flying around in four directions on the screen. It's sort of Space Wars control style where you move your orientation with arrow keys, but then you actually have a thrust button to move you in whatever direction you're facing, and you kind of maintain momentum once you turn the thrust off. And then you're destroying asteroids, enemy ships, trying to get the most points possible. Once you destroy all the asteroids on a screen, it clears, and then you move on to the next screen. You can move anywhere on the screen, and you and all of your enemies and the asteroids also wrap around all the edges of the screen. So that's all pretty much the same as the original. With that being said, though, let's move into my ratings for the game. For graphics, I gave it a 3.25 out of 10. There's only really some subtle changes to the graphics, but it really does look better than the original, even if it is just a little bit. Your ship in the original basically looks like a mouse cursor, and your ship in Asteroids Deluxe thankfully has more detail, looks really cool, kind of has like wings and a long nose. The asteroids spin slightly differently. It was hard to tell, but they did say in the manual that they tumble more realistically, so I'll take their word for it. And I also still enjoy the bright light of the shots. It's just this really bright white beam, or not beam, but like bullet that kind of comes out from the ship. And because it's vector graphics, the black and white looks really crisp. The explosion animations are fun because it just blows up into lots of pieces, so I enjoyed that. The Killer Satellite looks kind of plain, to be honest. It's just like a hexagon, but I do love that inside that hexagon, you can see all the little triangles that make it up that are going to break into ships to chase you once you shoot it. So you can kind of see, again, with vector graphics, like basically all the lines are drawn for the explosions and all that, like it's all part of something that was already on screen. So it's cool that as you break apart the Killer Satellite, you can already see the parts it's going to break into. I also think the painted background that the screen is reflected onto looks really good. I mean, it's a small thing, but from going straight from black and white in Asteroids to now this, and having this like dark green, eerie, spacey glow in the background, it just had so much more feel and color, literally, to the game, that I really enjoyed that. Moving on to sounds now, I gave this a 2.75 out of 10. The sounds, unfortunately, haven't changed, really, with the exception of some new noises for the Killer Satellite. So I wasn't really blown away. I mean, they're pretty decent. The original I rated sounds pretty high. But these are kind of sounding a little simple now in 1981. There's still that heartbeat sort of sound in the background, a good laser sound, some nice UFO noises, and none of them annoyed me, which is always a good thing. And the game always sounds full because there's all this stuff going on in a really nice way. There's not really a bunch of dead air in this game, so I really enjoyed that. Even if none of the sounds are standouts and crazy things we haven't seen before, it still sounds solid. Moving on to the important one now, gameplay. Does this improve on the original Asteroids gameplay? It's hard to say, which is a frustrating answer, I'm sure. I ended up giving it a 3.75 out of 10. I believe I gave the first one a 4, but honestly, they're very close to me. I think it makes changes that probably infuriated some of the pros on the original. But honestly, I think the changes do make things pretty fun. I like the shield option instead of hyperspace. It feels a lot more tactical and a lot less like an oh shit button, which is kind of what I felt like hyperspace was, just like, panic, and then you slap the button. Although I'm sure people could use that strategically as well. I also do like the killer satellites. They are very tough, but you can definitely find ways to engage them and move and position yourself to beat them. And it's kind of a fun challenge when you do overcome it, which I did a couple times. So I enjoyed that. The smarter UFOs also didn't feel too hard to me. Although, I mean, I was only on the first and second level, so maybe it ramps up pretty fast. And it's still the core gameplay that I enjoyed in the original Asteroids. So it's hard to say if it's more fun than the original for me. I do know that apparently, when it first released, it was way too hard for most average players. So they ended up in like other releases or in subsequent cabinets for this game, making it easier. So the general public in 1981 probably didn't like this that much because they just upped the difficulty for seemingly no reason. But I still had a good time with it for the little bit that I played it. For relevance, I gave it a 7 out of 10. Obviously not as relevant as the original Asteroids, but I think it still deserves some props for being the official sequel to Asteroids. Because of its difficulty, I don't think it's going to receive the same level of popularity, but I'm sure bars and arcades were still really excited to get their hands on, like, the next Asteroids. If Atari says we're doing a new Asteroids, they must have been pretty excited about it. And so overall, that gave me a 3.25 out of 10, which is pretty much what I gave the original. And I think that's a good sign. You know, sequels can be pretty bad. And this, you know, just did some things to shake up the quote unquote meta of the original. And while it was too difficult for some, I think the changes are fun and they made sense. None of them were like aggressively bad changes or additions to the game. They also really improved the presentation and the visuals, which I enjoyed a lot, especially the painted background. And it's just nice to see that Atari aren't phoning it in for this really important sequel. You know, they didn't do anything gigantic with it, but it could have been a disaster, like, well, at least a disaster in our minds, like Space Invaders 2. But Asteroids Deluxe, you know, it's a solid game, and that's kind of good enough for me.
Cool, man. I'm glad it didn't disappoint.
Yeah.
That's good. All right, with that being said, though, we are going to end it for today. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We did wrap up April of 1981, so next episode, we're going to be moving into May, which I'm super excited about.
Yeah.
But for today, I briefly mentioned Banana, Olympic Decathlon, and The Maze, which were all just kind of smaller games. But then you did Other Venture number 3, Escape from Tram, the next in the Other Venture series, which I always like to see. Always, like, whenever we play a text adventure, if it's got those graphics, then it's not so bad. So this one had that, at least. I checked out Missile Command on the Atari 2600, which I think was a faithful port, if just a little bit lacking in terms of creativity, maybe. And then you did Asteroids Deluxe, which was just kind of a follow-up to Asteroids to change the gameplay and make it so that you had to spend a little bit more quarters.
Basically.
Maybe that was fair.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this episode, keep joining us on our journey as we travel through our timeline in 1981 and beyond. We have a great website with tons of information on all the stuff we've covered before, which you should definitely check out. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter. I'm going to go with this time. Who knows next time that the name is going to change, where we post updates about our episodes. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.